Welcome to the Week in 60 Minutes, brought to you by Spectator TV, recorded on Thursday, March the 4th. On this week's show, there was a UK budget this week, you probably noticed. The Spectator's crack team of economic and political journalists will break it down for you. The successful vaccines rollout may also produce an economic recovery more quickly than we could have hoped for. I will be speaking to the statistician, David Spiegelhalter, about the vaccine effect. Meanwhile, the SNP's civil war rumbles on. Nicola Sturgeon is still Scotland's first minister, but as the Holyrood elections loom, is she now the walking wounded? And finally, could President Macron lose next year's French presidential election? I'll be chatting to the Spectator's South of France correspondent, Jonathan Miller, about the president's growing problems. All that to come in the next hour. As always, if you subscribe to The Spectator's YouTube channel, and why wouldn't you? It's free. You'll never miss a program. Just click the subscribe button at the bottom right of the screen. A very special thanks to Charles Stanley for their continued support of the Week in 60 Minutes this year. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms, one of the oldest companies on the London Stock Exchange. We're delighted to be partners with them. Now, lots to come up on the budget, but first let's get an update on where we are with the vaccine. The UK continues to lead Europe on the scale and efficiency of the vaccine rollout. Of course, it's in our interest that everybody in Europe and elsewhere is vaccinated, but it's good to see Britain doing something right. And who better to break down the significance of the numbers than Professor David Spiegelhalter. He's a statistician and chair of Cambridge's Winton Centre for Risk and Evidence Communication. Professor, welcome back to Spectator TV. Let me begin with a general question. Is it right, in your view, to see vaccine policy in some ways is now the government's major economic policy?
Without this vaccine, I mean, heaven knows how we'd be able to get out of this epidemic, especially with the new variants coming along. So it must go absolutely hand in hand with opening up society and the rebuilding of the economy. And that's why the comparisons between what's happening in the UK and what's happening certainly in the rest of Europe become so interesting.
Tell us where we are with the vaccine now. As I understand it, quite early on, the British government, obviously taking scientific advice, decided that it would give priority to getting as many of the target groups as possible the first dose. It knew it would need a second dose in weeks later, but the idea was rather than doing the first, then the second, to do as many first as possible, and then follow up with the second. That, I think, has been a vindicated strategy.
There were three bold decisions made at the beginning of the vaccine rollout and strongly influenced by the scientific opinion from JCVI, the committee responsible. The first in terms of the prioritisation, which is strictly based on a statistical analysis of who is most at risk. And so there was an absolutely clear objective to save the maximum number of lives, and which is also the number of years of life lost as well. So complete focus on that. And that are three implications. First of all, who got the vaccine first? Secondly, that they wanted to get as many first jabs into as many arms as possible with a delay on the second dose until 12 weeks. And this was very controversial, criticized by other countries as well. And thirdly, the idea that the AstraZeneca vaccine, although the trials had not included many people over 65, was fine to give to over 65s. Those three bold, controversial decisions have all been vindicated and have led to the staggering success of our vaccine rollout and the clear signs of its effectiveness now.
Now tell me, who have we done? Who is now covered by the vaccine, even if it's just the first dose? Because I think that still gives you quite a high percentage of efficacy. And who's going to be next?
Well, we worked down through, you know, the people in care homes, then the over 80s, the over 70s, people on the clinically extremely vulnerable list and so on. And so very high percentages in these groups have been vaccinated. We're now down to the 60s. I got myself done, which is great, just in, you know, as part of the group. And now we're working down to the first nine groups will bring us down to 50-year-olds and include and people who right down to 18 who have some medical condition. So those are being done now with the aim that those first five groups, those first nine groups will be done certainly by, well, they've sort of said by mid-April, I think, but I think they could easily be done before that. And then obviously it has been contested who gets it next, should it be prioritised in terms of some occupations, but it looks like they're still deciding to work down through the age groups. And following this scientific discovery from a statistical analysis that age is the absolutely dominant factor. Your risk of catching and dying from the virus doubles for every 6 years you're older. And so that I think, again, is a very science-based conclusion.
And that would, from what you say then on that statistical basis, Professor, it would probably make sense for the government to continue on the trajectory that it's on, in other words, being age-driven.
Yeah, I think that's what they are driven. Clearly, it's very delicate because I can see that certain professions, we know, very public-facing professions do have a higher risk. But then if you were going to do that, you'd want to do taxi drivers, you'd want to do, you know, public transport drivers. All sorts of people would be then sort of demanding to be put up in the queue. So they have gone for essentially keeping it quite simple. I mean, they should have done men before women, for example, of the same age, but, you know, they've tried to keep it as simple as possible, and I can understand that. It's a bit like the tier system, which they don't want to go back to because the complexity of that gave rise to so many arguments that I can see they're preferring to keep things just simple and just say that's the way it's going. And I think what's also remarkable, there's no queue jumping. You cannot just get this vaccine. You cannot even, no matter if you, it's not like getting a test. If you pay money, you could get a test. I feel really proud of that. I feel deeply moved by the way we're all standing in our queue and we're getting our jabs.
And you can't buy it. The rich can't buy it.
I don't think you can. I wouldn't dare anyway on the black market. I mean, who knows what would be in the vial?
Yes, exactly. Are we getting evidence that in addition to preventing going down with the COVID, particularly going down severely to an extent of hospitalization, the evidence for that now seems for the vaccine's efficacy is quite strong. Is there evidence too that it also prevents transmission?
Yep, it's growing. Now, I mean, fortunately, the biggest effect is for the nastiest things. So we know that hospitalization just from one dose from this fantastic Scottish study showed a 85% reduction in hospitalizations from Pfizer, 94% from AstraZeneca. I should add, there's no difference between those numbers.
Yes.
So,
yes.
You know, it makes
all statistically, there's no difference.
No, there's no difference at all. You know, if you look at the, as we statisticians would look at the margins of error around those numbers, they completely overlap. So there's no basis for saying one is better for the other on the basis of that data. That's hospitalization. That means the protection against dying will be even higher than that. Very likely, we still haven't not had that many deaths following vaccination. And so it's very difficult to, we're not too confident about assessing that exactly, but I'm sure it's above 90% efficacy against death, against infection, against some disease, it'll be a bit lower than that. It looks like about 80 in the 80%. And against infection, maybe, you know, 60-70% protection against infection, growing evidence for that. But it does depend on the variant, possibly. So though there is protection against infection, but even greater protection against the more severe outcomes, which is what we're most interested in.
It's encouraging to see Britain doing well in this, given all the mistakes that were about to be made around this time last year, which has set us back. Of course, it was uncharted territory for everybody then. But of course, and of course, you can, you know, I'm sure there's some people in Britain will take a certain comfort from the fact that Europe is making a bit of mess of things in some areas. But of course, we can't really be free until our friends in Europe are also on the same trajectory as we are. And they're quite far behind, Professor. I mean, I'm coming to you from France. They've only done 7% And the president's attacks on AstraZeneca have given the already quite a strong anti-vax movement in France a reason for not taking the AstraZeneca. There are, as we speak, about a million unused AstraZeneca doses.
This is a complete tragedy, and I'm not sure, it's not very polite to refer to a president of a great country as an idiot, but really, that frankly is when he said, oh, it's quasi ineffective in over 65s, was both totally wrong, grossly misleading, and has had apparently a big effect. People don't want this AstraZeneca vaccine, which we're now seeing in real world is doing fantastically well. So this is tragic. This is costing lives. Vaccines, it's not like going into, super drug and deciding what headache tablet I'm going to get. If you don't get this, you're not going to get a vaccine for some time. And so I've got relatives in Italy in their 70s, absolutely no sign of a vaccine coming for them yet. I think this is appalling. And now, in Britain, we're working right down through, as we've heard, through younger and younger people, and this is having a huge effect. So, as you said, we want everyone to be vaccinated so that we can restore some confidence in travelling and moving around. So this is tragic, and it's going to cost a very large number of lives in mainland Europe, I think.
It was more damaging, I think, in France than people even in Britain realise, because attacking the AstraZeneca one, which is the one that doesn't need special cold storage, unlike the Pfizer one, and yet France does not have a nationwide chain of the cold storage that could handle the Pfizer. So actually the AstraZeneca would have been better for them because you don't need that cold storage. But even what we tend to think of, Professor, as the more level-headed, more pragmatic Germans, they've kind of gone down this route.
Yeah, it was their regulatory agencies. The European Medicines Agency did approve AstraZeneca for over 65s on the same basis as we did, that there was no evidence that it was not effective. And a lot of, in a way, indirect evidence that it was, just from what we know about vaccines, what we saw about the immune response it generated in older people. And so, in a way, the precautionary approach would be to give it to the over 65s, because otherwise this is going to cost lives. But whereas many of the national regulatory agencies in Germany and elsewhere thought, oh, we're going to be cautious because we haven't got evidence that it works, so we're not going to approve it. Well, no, that, they're changing their minds. Yes. Too late. They brought up distrust in this treatment and in this vaccine, and it's going to take a long time to reverse that public opinion. So it's a total disaster in terms of the processing of the scientific evidence and the communication of it. And as I said, this country's made one mess up after another in many ways. But it's really good at this stage with the new variant spreading, throughout the rest of Europe, that we have at last done something right.
Final question, Professor, for today. If the rollout continues to be the success it is, and the good news about the power, the efficacy of the vaccines continues to come in too, should the government consider a quicker exit from lockdown? Or should it just be cautious? June isn't that far away. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. What would you
advise? You know not to ask me what the government should do, because I'm not going to say. I have said before, a number of times, that we are coming up to a massive argument, because the rate at which deaths, for example, are coming down in this country, I don't think, was more better than anyone would have predicted, I think. We're going to see, I'm obviously certain, I think now before Easter, no excess deaths in this country, that the total death rate will be below the 5-year average. And there will be enormous demands to speed up the release. But I do think that we've got to be very cautious. And I think, they did say data, not dates, and then said a whole lot of dates. Come on. No, but so I'm going to say that they should be looking at the data and being cautious. Let's see the result of opening up schools. Let's see the result at each step. Let's see what happens. And to be cautious, because especially, with the new variants coming along, there's a real risk of a big blow up. We have protected the most vulnerable, but if it takes off among the unvaccinated, we could still see a huge impact on the health, and we'd have to then start closing things up again, and they don't want to do that.
We certainly don't, Professor. Professor, we're going to have to close up, but as always, it's been a pleasure having you on Spectator TV. Thank you for joining us
today.
That's Cambridge University's David Spiegelhalter speaking to us, one of our country's top statisticians, if not the top statistician, in fact. I'm still working with my abacus, so I'm not really quite in that league yet. Let's get to the budget. The giveaway chancellor was still giving away in this week's budget, but there was a later sting in the tail, a huge rise in taxes from 2023 onwards to help pay for all this spending and to restore some order to the public finances in terms of the annual borrowing amount and the overall national debt, which is now in the trillions. Let's go to get a briefing from our economics correspondent, Kate Andrews.
Thanks, Andrew. This week, the Chancellor presented his second budget to the House. Rishi Sunak at this point is no stranger to splashing the cash, and this was no exception. We got £65 billion of additional spending. A lot of that's going to go on immediate COVID relief, extending the furlough scheme till September, extending that uplift to universal credit, business grants, and much more. But in addition to the giveaways, we also got some tough pills to swallow in the form of tax hikes. Corporation tax is going up to 25% for big business by 2023, and there's also been a freeze to personal tax thresholds. I'm sure we're going to discuss that after the slideshow, but I want to look at the Office for Budget Responsibility and what they published alongside the budget, because we got some updated forecasts that gives us some insight as to where we think the economy is headed and what we can make from that. So as you can see from this first slide, the OBR have brought forward their projection of reaching pre-pandemic levels of GDP to Q2 next year. It's not that much of a change. It was expected to be Q3, but it is something. Here you can see that big contraction of 9.9% for 2020. This year, we're expected to grow by 4%. Next year, really quite amazing, 7%. And then returning to business as usual after that with an average of roughly 1.6% growth. Now, the reason that 4% is there for this year reflects the fact that we're going to be in a very strict lockdown in winter and hopefully be open and having a booming economy in the summer. And data from the OECD, which has been analyzed by The Spectator, has found that despite low levels of COVID in the UK compared to our European counterparts, the UK is not only one of the most locked down countries, but it's also suffering from some of the slowest GDP growth per week if you compare our GDP to last year. Now, what this slide is really showing is that quite obviously, the more locked down you are, the harder it is to bounce back. And that means that we're not going to have the same level of growth this year that we may potentially have next year. But moving on to other news from the OBR, really good news, actually, if we look at unemployment. Originally, the OBR had forecast 11.9% to be the peak of unemployment, and that's fallen right down to 6.5%. This really boosts the credibility of the furlough scheme and perhaps explains why it's being extended till September, with hopes that with the economy very open this summer, conditions will be better for those furloughed workers, many of whom may discover their job doesn't exist anymore, will be able to come into a jobs market that is perhaps a bit more active. But none of this has been cheap. And as you can see here, the debt is now estimated to be at £2.8 trillion. If deficit projections are anything to go by, it's going to keep going up by quite a lot. Public spending was up by a quarter in a year last year, £355 billion borrowed in 2020-2021. It's forecast for 2021-22, that's going to be £234 billion. You can no longer say that the COVID crisis is a one-off spending spree. By the time we get to 2024-2025, we're still borrowing, estimated to be borrowing, over £100 billion a year. Now, some people will say that's really not a problem because look here at this slide, how cheap it is to service that debt. But there are still several issues here. It's not just about the amount of debt, but the ratio of debt to GDP that really matters, which is now hovering just below 100%. And second, and perhaps this is the most important slide actually to explain this budget, is just how vulnerable we are when it comes to servicing that debt. And that's what we're looking at in this week's magazine, the fear that was playing on the Chancellor's mind when he decided to hike taxes and present the budget that he did. Because while conditions for borrowing are extremely agreeable right now, if there's even the slightest bit of movement, historically low movement, as you can see here, one percentage point change in interest rates, gilt rates, or in inflation, then we could be looking at a £25 billion black hole that the Chancellor would have to fill. That's roughly finding the school's budget. If it's a 2 percentage point increase, that's finding the defense budget. And that could prove extremely painful for the country, and very politically difficult for the Conservative Party, having to come up with that money in such a short period of time. So it's this concern, I think, that has really driven what you saw in the budget this week, which we can discuss now. So back over to you, Andrew.
Okay, Kate, thank you for that and for these fascinating charts. I'm going to come back to the economics of the budget in a minute, but let me come to our political editor, James Forsyth, and some of the politics of this. James, is there now talk in Westminster? Because he's talking about, you know, no tax increases for a while, but then from 2023 onwards, there's quite substantial increases both in corporation tax and in household on income tax as well, because the thresholds are going to be frozen. Almost every threshold is actually being frozen. Are we thinking of a 2023 election now?
I don't think there is a firm date in the government's mind when they want to have the election. But I think when you heard the Chancellor read out the growth forecast, talking about, you know, 7% growth plus in 2022, then 1.7% in 2023, and then 1.6, 1.5, you would surely want to have the election as close to that 7%, that year of 7% growth with a feel-good factor, rather than have it after a couple of years of 1.6, you know, fairly anemic growth, you know, solid but not spectacular. I also think the other calculation that has shifted is, I think 6 months ago, when the government's handling of the pandemic was being widely panned, public confidence was low, you would think the government would want to hold the election as far away from COVID as possible. But as your discussion with David Spiegelhalter showed, you know, there is something the government is now getting right, the vaccine rollout. And the UK might be able to get rid of restrictions quicker than other European countries, get life back to normal. And so, again, you might have a kind of halo effect from that you would want to tap into in an election campaign.
And of course, before the Fixed Term Parliament Act, which sort of mandated, except in special circumstances, a 5-year parliament, 4 years, I think, James, was about the norm for most parliaments, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the issue here is that this would be 3.5 years, essentially, because I don't think anyone wants to go to the polls in the winter again, as happened at the last election. So you would probably be talking about a kind of classic May 2023 kind of date. But you are right. You know, normally, parliaments only went the full 5 years if a government was in trouble. Think of John Major in 1997. You know, you clung on desperately in the hope that something would turn up. But normally, look at Margaret Thatcher, successful governments like, or Tony Blair, successful governments like to go after 4 years.
Fraser, our editor of the Spectator, I listened to the Chancellor on the Today programme on Radio 4 this morning, and I thought he came really unstuck over corporation tax. I'm interested to see what your take is on this. I mean, for 10 years, when I interviewed Tories about the cost of the corporation tax cuts, they all said, but they'll pay for themselves. You know, there'll be a sort of Laffer curve effect, and we'll end up with more revenue. Now the Chancellor is telling us that if he ups corporation tax, he'll take in more revenue than he would otherwise. I mean, both statements can't be right, can they?
Well, we're certainly stretching the elastic of what used to be Tory economics. And I mean, the people you were talking to, Andrew, were actually quite correct. And corporation tax did keep going down, but the revenue kept going up. Now, might it have gone up even higher if there were higher rates? The thing is that corporation tax was a little bit of a misleading indicator, because the actual burden of tax the companies face has got a lot to do with the deductions of what they can count off against tax. So what George Osborne was quite good at doing was lowering the headline rate of corporation tax, but also taking away the deductions, so companies pretty much ended up paying the same. There's a very interesting part in the OBR documents where they show exactly the ruse here. The rate went down, but the actual burden stayed high. So in a way, the great giveaway was never quite as generous as it seemed. Now, you could argue Rishi Sunak's coming along saying, look, I'm going to increase the allowances. I'm going to let you write off 130% of the value of machinery that you might buy against tax. And isn't that generous? That raises the prospect of a kind of reversal of the Osborne years. The allowance is getting more generous, even though the rate is going up. But when you look at the OBR's calculations, it shows you that the rate is going up way, way faster than the allowances. This is going to be the biggest increase in corporation tax since Dennis Healey in 1974. And we're going to end up with one of Europe's heaviest corporation taxers. Now, what you can't... I mean, Rishi Sunak was asked on the radio this morning, what have you stopped believing that if you lower the tax rates, the yields might go up? That was a bit of a trick question, because somebody who is a supply side or in the Tory party would say that's only the case for certain circumstances. The top rate of tax, for example, you could lower that and the rate would probably go up. But then again, it's probably marginal. But the truth, which Rishi Sunak wouldn't admit, is that corporation tax is one of the only taxes he's got to play with. The manifesto stops him increasing income tax. The Prime Minister stops him curtailing the spending because number 10 is a very spend-happy administration. Poor old Rishi Sunak, it's his job to somehow finance the spending being authorised in number 10, but do it being banned from touching most taxes apart from corporation tax. I suspect it won't raise nearly as much money as he thinks, but unfortunately it's the only tool he really has to play with.
Kate, I was fascinated by your cover story this week of The Spectator and the spectre of inflation, because it has been the kind of hovering in the background. We've been in this incredibly benign atmosphere for so long that governments can borrow at the lowest possible interest rates, the cost of servicing the debt. No, I mean, the size of our national debt at the moment is at wartime levels, but the cost of servicing the debt is a lot lower than it was when our national debt was a lot smaller. But that all changes if inflation was to come back, and that would make the bond markets nervous and it would make fiscal positions far less sustainable. And I was interested that you think the Chancellor is worried about this.
Absolutely. There's been a lot of talk leading up to the budget that the Chancellor might be raising taxes to pay down the debt. I don't think the Chancellor at the moment has such lofty dreams. This is about a much more immediate concern, and that is that these conditions for borrowing that are so agreeable at the moment only need to change just slightly for him to be in a really difficult position. And weeks ago, frankly, the economic consensus seemed to be that everything was going to be fine. It would be rude not to borrow this money. It's so cheap. It's so cheap to service the debt. But something has started to change. Now, you don't have major economists coming out and predicting inflation, but you have very senior people like Larry Summers, who is by no means a fiscal hawk. He was Treasury Secretary under Bill Clinton, economic guru to Barack Obama. In the United States, he's looking at Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion stimulus package, which is going to land just as the economy is booming open because the U.S. is having a big vaccine success story at the moment. And he's saying this is extremely risky. We may well be risking inflation. And over here, you have the chief economist of the Bank of England, Andy Haldane, releasing a speech last week all on this topic. Again, not going so far as to predict it, but he concludes by saying this is a real possibility. We are very vulnerable. We just don't know what happens when you artificially suppress an economy and then open the doors again. We don't have a playbook for this. So credible people are talking about it, and it's certainly weighing on the Chancellor's mind. He wants to make sure that if interest rates, gilt yields, inflation budge ever so slightly, he's going to be able to find, as I showed in that graph, 25 billion pounds, potentially more, in order to cover it.
James, there have been movements in the bond markets in recent days that corroborate what Kate is saying. But this, if this is now a concern, this goes way beyond the British government. I mean, this plays to the heart of the debt dynamics of the Eurozone. I mean, if you look at France could now be heading towards a debt to GDP ratio of about 120%. I think Italy is already over 140 and rising. Portugal's not far behind. Spain is enormous as well. All that debt's been financed either through European Central Bank QE or been done by the governments themselves because interest rates are so low and they've been able to get their debt away. If what Kate is saying is now coming onto the policy agenda, that's a real problem for the Eurozone.
Yeah, and I mean, there are two other factors worth considering here. One is that the QE that followed the financial crisis essentially went into repairing banks' balance sheets. So it didn't really go into the real economy. The QE that has happened during this crisis has gone into consumers' pockets. And also, if you look at the amount of savings that have been built up in this country during the pandemic, you can quite easily see how when people come out, you know, but there's a rush for home improvements and the like, and that creates an inflationary pressure. Then you add to that, as Kate says, you know, the US has the global reserve currency, so it has far more room for manoeuvre. But it could, but you look at the size of this Biden stimulus, and it could be about to inject quite a sizable bit of inflation into the world system. I think you saw the Bank of Japan getting nervous about this. You know, this is going to be a big issue. And as you say, you know, the Eurozone, you know, I always think this about the Eurozone. We've stopped talking about the euro. But its problems are still there. It is simply just in an acute state rather in a chronic state rather than an acute state. If interest rates start rising, you know, it could get back into the acute state really quite fast.
Fraser, you know, over the years, as we've done our budget shows in the aftermath and so on, we've talked about how the government from 2010 onwards was trying to get the annual deficit down bit by bit as a percentage of GDP. Was it succeeding or not? And whatever it did, of course, national debt continued to rise. Of course, all these figures, we used to be talking about an annual deficit of about, you know, 40, 45 billion pounds. I think the one this year is going to be over 300 billion. In your view, given that the Chancellor does seem to be aware of the concerns that Kate was raising, is Britain's fiscal position as sustainable as it can be in the current climate?
It's difficult to say, really. I mean, could we have got away, could we have got through this crisis with less debt? I think the answer is certainly we could have done. If you look at the deficit that we had during 2020, the UK was one of the worst hit countries economically. And that is linked to the stringency of lockdown. Not only was our economy hit the worst, but our debt went up the most. And the funny thing is, though, that I think this budget was written not yesterday in the Treasury, but it was written when the government decided to extend the most stringent lockdown in the world, as it currently is, for as long as they have done. When you extend furlough scheme until September, long after reopening is supposed to be going on, when you start to answer every single problem with a massive spending splurge, then you start to create the biggest tax burden in 50 years. And that's what we've ended up with. I think what Rishi Sunak is doing is holding up a mirror to the Prime Minister here, saying, look, this is the bill for everything that you've promised. This is the bill for the toughest lockdown in the world. And every week it continues, it simply gets more expensive and somebody's going to have to pay for that money. So I think that we could have got through this crisis without doing as much fiscal damage as we did. But it's a bit too late now for that. The Prime Minister has tied himself to his dates, not data schedule of moving out of lockdown. The Bank of England has also printed as much money as the government has borrowed. So what we really don't know is what the markets are going to think of the continued hunger for deficit spending after the Bank of England stops printing. So we're about as stable as any other European country right now, which is to say not very. No country really knows how it's going to be until, first of all, the quantitative easing stops. Secondly, the economies rebound and we can see how strong that is. And thirdly, we wait for the fallback from Joe Biden's massive spending splurge, which could trigger the inflationary wave. He pours lots of vodka on the post-pandemic party that America is about to have with a bailout, which is something like four times the size of a stimulus that Obama did after the crash. So we've got a lot of question marks and a lot of questions that will be answered by the end of this year.
And Kate, that is a concern in London, isn't it? The size of the Biden stimulus almost $2 trillion on top of what Trump had done and other spending as well. And as you look at some of the supply side constraints already visible in America, even labor in some constraint too, housing, things you need to build houses and all the rest of it, people are having trouble sourcing quite a lot. Supply chains already coming under pressure. There's a fear, as I understand it, that if inflation kicks off in America as a result of this, that makes the danger all the worse for Britain.
Oh, certainly. What happens in America is going to affect the rest of the world. And as Andy Haldane laid out in his speech last week, he says that what kept inflation so low for so long, those conditions have fundamentally changed. We're not going to have another China come onto the world market, for example. And as you say, Andrew, globalization's taken a real hit. We just don't know how quickly it'll come back, if it's going to limp or if it's going to roar back. Now, before the budget, you had people saying Rishi Sunak is going to use Joe Biden as cover to hike corporation tax, to do these big state things, because the president's doing it as well. And in the magazine this week, I note that a senior Tory source says that's not quite the case. In fact, it's very, very different from that. Rishi Sunak's not trying to be Joe Biden. He's trying to protect from what Joe Biden might do to the UK economy. Because as Friedrich Hayek once famously noted, inflation is like a tiger and you're trying to chase it by its tail. Once the cat's out of the bag, it's near impossible to catch. So if things start to move, they could start to move really quickly. And now the key is that nothing may change. And that will be hard for the Chancellor. If his fears that he's planning for, if they don't become a reality, people will say, well, you were yet again overly cautious, you were too prudent, this was unnecessary pain. But if something were to change, the Chancellor would be the person who prepared for it, who planned for it, and who tried to make the UK slightly more resilient to what might be happening in the States or elsewhere.
James, let me come to you for a final question of this segment. My understanding is that despite the tax rises and all the rest of it, the Tory backbenchers are not in a revolting mood. They, by and large, they're either accepting it or they're keeping their lips buttoned for the moment. But if the election is to come in 2023, given the importance of the red wall, the seats that they won in 2019, old Labour seats, that some seats they had won for a generation, if ever, and they've got this levelling up agenda as well, with some money being spent, are they really going to be in a position, as they go around the red wall constituencies by 2023, to say, look at this improvement we've done here. Look how this town centre is booming here. Look how we've cleared these slums. We've built a new clinic. You know, all the things. Will there really be visible signs like that, that they can say, this is a real improvement compared to 2019?
I mean, this is one of the big challenges for them. You know, I think that lots of voters in these red wall seats take their state of their local high street as a proxy for, is where they live better off than it was 4 years ago? I think one of the problems is COVID has accelerated all of the changes hitting the high street, you know, the shift from bricks and mortar retail to online, for instance. So I think they are going to have to do kind of big planning reform to make the high street more residential, things like that. I also think, though, that the public will accept that, you know, the government have lost a whole bunch of time to COVID. I think one of the challenges for Labour is, you know, that they thought that they would be able to say quite definitively at the next election, the Tories have been in power for 14 years, and once you've been in power for 14 years, you know, essentially everything is your fault. But, you know, I mean, how much longer do you need to fix it? I think now the political argument will be slightly different. The government will be talking about being 2 years into its COVID recovery plan, you know, this Build Back Better slogan. So I think voters will get that, you know, there has been an interruption. But I think, as you say, the particular problem, I think, is that in these places, people will say, well, you know, my local high street, and that high streets have undoubtedly been one of the things that hit hardest by COVID.
Thank you for that. Kate, I think we can release you. We're holding on to James and Fraser because we're going to Scotland now, and the Scottish drama continues to unfold this week. Nicola Sturgeon gave evidence to the Scottish Parliamentary Inquiry. It's into how our government handled sexual harassment complaints against Alex Salmond. And it ended, of course, in total failure and some substantial expense for the Scottish taxpayer. Last week, Salmond had testified to that inquiry. This week, it was Nicola Sturgeon. The inquiry, however, has been hamstrung by the desire of the Sturgeon government to suppress essential information, with the willing complicity of the government Crown Office, which issues, it seems, almost daily threats to anybody thinking of defying it. But this week, the Parliament did force the publication of the government's own legal advice, and it proved to be pretty devastating. Now, look, I understand it's a complicated, murky tale, but The Spectator has all the latest developments. It's on our new Scotland homepage, and it's at spectator.co.uk/Scotland. That's spectator.co.uk/Scotland. And you'll get all the stuff we've been writing about this if you really want to come up to speed, and it's particularly of interest if you live in Scotland, because you may be getting a little bit of a different perspective than to what the local press has given you about this. So go to that. Westminster may not be paying enough attention, but The Spectator certainly is north of the border. Let's bring in our in-house journalists, following the story from the beginning. Fraser and James are still here. And Spectator contributor from north of the border, Stephen Daisley. Stephen, let me go to you first. It's now 24 hours since Nicola Sturgeon began her testimony before the inquiry. What was the fallout this morning? What was the general mood in the Scottish media about how she had done?
Well, Andrew, I think if you peruse the newspapers in Scotland this morning, the general line was that there were still major questions looming over Nicola Sturgeon's version of events. I think that I have said myself this morning in a piece that I've written for the Scottish Daily Mail that
I read it. I enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. Well, the point I made in that is that I think Nicola Sturgeon, she gave a lawyerly performance. It wasn't a theatrical performance like Alex Salmond gave, but it was a typically lawyerly performance. She answered the question she wanted to answer, and she didn't make, I would say she didn't make any major gaffes in the room. And I would even add that I think that she did succeed in casting some doubts on aspects of Alex Salmond's narrative. You know, she kept making the point as to why would I want to bring such a huge scandal upon my own party, I think that she sort of managed to come across well in a very sort of legalistic sense. However, there are still major questions that remain about her evidence, and I would argue actually that these questions are even more difficult for her to answer, and yet more pressing for her to answer as a result of yesterday. So we heard yesterday that Nicola Sturgeon admitted that yes, she had this secret meeting with Alex Salmond at her private home in Glasgow.
This was on April the 2nd, 2018.
That's correct, on Easter Monday 2018, and she said that she believed this meeting was on party business. Her husband and SNP chief executive, Peter Murrell, had previously testified that he considered it to be Scottish government business. Now, that's one of the major inconsistencies that was not answered yesterday. Which one of them was being accurate in their description of the nature of the meeting? The next point was the failure to disclose that meeting itself. Now, Nicola Sturgeon said yesterday that she considered this meeting to be party political business, and then she went on to recount how Alex Salmond had showed her a letter he had received from the Permanent Secretary outlining allegations against him, and she spoke about, in some way, her voice actually was sort of breaking at points about how shocked she was about the nature of the allegations. Yet and still, she did not go from that meeting, at which it was very clear that at the point that letter was handed over to her, that it was now a government-related meeting. She did not go from there to tell the civil service, "I have just had a meeting that is germane to this investigation." And it was another 2 months before she did that. Now, what she said yesterday was, well, she was concerned that doing that would have sort of jeopardised confidentiality, and it would have put civil servants in a sort of an invidious position, because technically, as First Minister, she wasn't supposed to know about this investigation. That is not something I think that is a supportable or sustainable argument.
No, and Stephen, having looked through the Scottish Ministerial Code, the Ministerial Code does not give her that discretion. It doesn't say, well, but if there are other considerations, you don't need to report it. It says you have to report it. If it's a government meeting, you report it.
Absolutely. And that point was made yesterday in the committee, and Nicola Sturgeon didn't really have an answer for it. And it is a, how do I put this politely, it's an innovative interpretation of the Scottish Ministerial Code, that there is some, you know, power for the ministers who are bound by it to decide in the circumstances that that they have to comply with it. I think that's certainly a big question that came out yesterday. Another one that I think we're going to be talking about a lot more down the line is this claim that the name of one of the complainants who had come forward to accuse Alex Salmond was given to an associate of Mr. Salmond, to Jeff Aberdeen, his former chief of staff, in a meeting with a Scottish Government official. Now, that claim from Alex Salmond or from his camp that has now received corroboration from Kevin Pringle, who's a former special advisor to the Scottish Government, and from Duncan Hamilton, who former SNP MSP and also now a practitioner in law, and he's a very well-respected QC.
These are our own people. These are SNP people.
They are, and you know there is. I think it's worth noting as well about Kevin Pringle, who's sort of very well regarded across the political spectrum and also across all the factions within the SNP. He said in his statement to the Scottish Government, you know, he referred to a piece he'd previously written in the Sunday Times, saying that he wants justice, or as he sees it, for Alex Salmond, he wants the right thing to be done. Done, but at the same time, he has no desire to see Nicola Sturgeon, not continue as First Minister. So this is not a factional thing. Now, what Hamilton and Pringle's evidence is important because it does provide corroboration to some degree of what Alex Salmond is claiming. And the question then becomes, because Nicola Sturgeon, you know, she makes the point that neither Pringle nor Hamilton were in this meeting, and so they are just relaying what Jeff Aberdeen told them. The question though then becomes, well, what corroboration does Nicola Sturgeon have? Because it became clear yesterday in her exchanges with committee members that there had not been any what I would sort of call it a formal sort of investigation process or fact finding process to determine what was said at the meeting from the Scottish Government senior official that has been referred to. You know, how, you know, if the Salmond camp can sort of produce these two sworn statements by members of the SNP saying, you know, we were told that this happened, that a complainant's name was given to Jeff Aberdeen, which, you know, I think we tend to breeze by this, but that is a huge thing if that happened. That is an extraordinary breach of confidence. The question is,
I'll come back to you, of course, but let me just go to Fraser. Fraser, I watched most of the testimony yesterday. It was long. I think it ended up being about 8 hours. And she started very strongly, and there were long periods when she was across the brief, so much so that she hardly ever had to refer to the papers in front of her. She was confident at times, and she had some detail. But as the afternoon went on, and the Labour's Jackie Bailey and the Tories' Murdo Fraser, your namesake, Fraser, began to really needle her about these meetings with her aide in early March, and then the meeting that she apparently had forgotten about in late March, and then leading to the meeting on April the 2nd that we've just been talking to Stephen about. She did seem more flustered and more defensive. Did you agree with that?
Yes, she didn't have a good answer to that question, and it was pretty obvious that this is the issue where she is technically most exposed, on the dates which she gave versus what we now know to be the truth. But your average Scot might listen to this and think, well, does it really matter that much if she had this meeting on the 2nd of April or the 28th of March? Does it really matter that much if the meeting was categorised as a government meeting or a party meeting? If she got muddled over that, she said at one point in the evidence that she just thought of Easter Monday, she didn't think of it as what day in March or April it was, then is it really that big a scandal? Are you really saying she ought to resign because several years ago she got a certain date wrong? But I think the SNP would be quite happy if the overall question went in that direction, because the bigger problem, I think, is something that we saw earlier on Tuesday. It's about the way this whole inquiry has been conducted and the way that the SNP government is basically behaving with impunity and dodging the scrutiny. It's not so much the actual sin, it's the cover-up and the mechanisms of the cover-up, which I think are so shocking. For example, let's take the Lord Advocate. He runs the Crown Office, the Prosecutors, Scotland's answer of the Crown Prosecution Service. Now, the Lord Advocate basically told the committee that they had to censor Alex Salmond's evidence that they had published. So an incredible thing to say. The Crown Office, which is run by a member of Nicola Sturgeon's cabinet, is saying to the Parliament, no, you can't publish that evidence, evidence which, by the way, the bit that was censored just happens to be rather embarrassing for Nicola Sturgeon. So he was called in front of the committee on Tuesday and asked to explain himself. But rather than being apologetic, the tone of a Lord Advocate's evidence really showed you just where power lies. He told the MSPs, extraordinarily in my view, that they were punishable. So here you've got a member of Sturgeon's government informing politicians that they are punishable under the law. Now, what he meant by that was, as opposed to Westminster, where you can say what you want, you can ask what you want in a committee, you don't have to worry about being sued because you've got parliamentary privilege, that privilege does not exist in Scotland. The MSPs are indeed vulnerable to being punished, to use the Lord Advocate's word, by the law if they're deemed to be in contempt of court. And what's happening right now is they're waiving the prospect of this contempt of court bill, saying you can't identify the complainants, as being a device to try to chill discussion, to make people nervous about what they say. So the Lord Advocate's overall approach, I thought, was extraordinary. He told the politicians that they were punishable, but when they asked him if ministers are punishable, if, to use Alex Salmond's example, if you didn't hand over documents when there was a search warrant asking you to hand over the documents, would that have been against the law? James Wolfe, Lord Advocate, he couldn't say. He said, well, that's a bit hypothetical. It's funny that he wasn't shy about telling the MSPs that they were punishable. But the government, that seems to be a different matter entirely. So the overall impression we get from this inquiry is not really a debate about who said what and what particular dates, important though that is. It's the overall impression that a new establishment has taken root in Scotland, which is more powerful and perhaps less accountable than the old establishment ever was.
James, you've been watching this. What are your thoughts? I thought she was on the ropes a bit, trying to explain why she had not followed the clear advice of her external counsel. Her external counsel being the leading QC in Scotland, Dean of the Faculty of Advocates. It doesn't get better than that, north of the border. And she had trouble trying to explain why, for so long, the Scottish government seemed to ignore the fact that their case was going to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah, and I think the real scandal here is at one point, Rory Dunlop complains of the extreme professional embarrassment that he and his junior on the case have suffered. And the crucial point is the reason why. It's because the government is not releasing documents until the very last minute, and these documents contradicted things that had previously been told to the court. So, yes, you can argue that they don't say that the case should be conceded until December, but they would have said that a lot earlier if the correct documents had been handed over to the court as early as they should have been. I mean, why that didn't happen is a big question. I personally think on Nicola Sturgeon's testimony, I thought her weakest bit, which she herself almost acknowledged, is forgetting, in inverted commas, this 29th of March meeting with Jeff Aberdeen in the Scottish Parliament, when she is told, you know, that Alex Salmond wants to see her and the kind of reason why. I find that bit remarkable. She talks about how shocked she was at the meeting in her own home. But if you're told that someone wants a meeting with you and that you think that would lodge in your memory, and I think that is a challenge for her. We're meant to be getting more of the legal advice later today. It'll be interesting to see how that reflects compared to the testimony she has given. My sense yesterday watching that testimony is that, you know, that this committee ain't going to be able to come to a conclusion. It is too split down party lines to write a report of any weight. So I think everything now turns to James Hamilton, the QC, who is investigating whether or not the ministerial code was broken. You know, Nicola Sturgeon is clearly relying on that verdict. She can have kept saying to the committee, well, that's for James Hamilton to decide on that front. And I think what he decides will be of huge consequence now. And also, there's a massive question about the timing of his report. Is that going to come out before Scottish voters go to the polls in May? You know, there is something rather unseemly about the fact that Nicola Sturgeon won't give firm dates in her lockdown map, but wants to get this election happening despite all the restrictions that are remaining in place. I think it suggests that the SNP don't think the situation is going to develop to their advantage if they maybe delayed that poll until September.
Stephen, the Scottish voters may find it quite hard to go through, you know, what's the significance of from March the 29th to April the 2nd? It was almost 3 years ago now, reporting a meeting, is it a party meeting, government meeting? But the Hamilton inquiry by this Irish QC, he'll think it's important. I mean, he is the person appointed by the Scottish Parliament, the Scottish government, to enforce the ministerial code. So that is, that in some ways, although the parliamentary inquiries had all the publicity, that could be a bigger threat to Nicola Sturgeon than the parliamentary inquiry.
Yes, I think that's correct. And that is a view, I should say, Andrew, that has been voiced to me by MSPs of various parties for quite some time now. I think the view has been at Holyrood for a while that the, as James referred to, this committee is just so split, and indeed it is so hampered, and not just by the Crown Office, but actually by the, its very remit from the start, and some, you know, some might argue deliberately limited in its remit from the start. And so now all eyes will turn to James Hamilton. Now, that in fact there is a, you know, another argument as to whether his remit is broad enough, because it does go to sort of specific questions about ways in which the ministerial code was broken and not others. And Jackie Bailey, who is, as we've said, a member of the Holyrood Committee, she has previously questioned whether the James Hamilton inquiry should be broader. I think the thrust, however, is very much that, you know, James Hamilton is a very well respected legal mind, former Irish prosecutor, very well respected. I think I'm right in saying he was originally recruited to this sort of independent investigator role at the Scottish Government by Alex Salmond.
He was indeed recruited by Mr. Salmond.
And I think reappointed by Nicola Sturgeon. We don't know, because, as you say, there hasn't been the same publicity around it. The Hamilton inquiry is not happening in sort of real time on sort of our televisions, so it's difficult to know where he's going to come down. But you know, again, I think yesterday, some of the remarks, that some of the testimony Nicola Sturgeon gave, you know, particularly in this question about informing the civil service about this meeting with Alex Salmond, at which she herself said she was given a copy, or handed a copy of a letter from the Permanent Secretary to Alex Salmond, and yet it took her another 2 months to tell civil servants about that. I think it is, it's difficult. I'll put it this way, I'll be interested to see what James Hamilton thinks of that, because I think to come to the conclusion that that is in some way, was in any way, you know, proper, or she had no other choice, that, you know, opens huge questions about the ministerial code, and not just at Holyrood, you know, it opens huge questions about ministers' right to interpret and almost, if you like, add little asterisks to the terms that bind them, and the fallout from that is potentially even bigger than this matter itself.
Yep, the story still has some way to run, that's for sure. Inquiries going on, the May elections. I mean, my instinct is that, Nicola Sturgeon has lived to fight another day. She's tenacious, no question about that. But it could be that she's going to be heading to the May elections as the walking wounded. And although it is almost certain she will still be, quote, the winner, what has happened could well deny her an overall majority. And that would have huge constitutional significance. For a second referendum without an overall majority, she will find it much harder to demand a second referendum. Gentlemen, we'll leave it there. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back. This story goes on. But for the moment, let's go to France. France has got another presidential election next year. It seems, can't believe it's almost 4 years since President Emmanuel Macron won the French presidential election on a beautiful spring night. I remember being there in Paris as he won comfortably over Marine Le Pen. Can he get re-elected next year? French terms are now only 5 years. They used to be seven for president. In this week's Spectator, Jonathan Miller, who writes lots of great stuff for us about France, he writes about a potential challenger, an Eric Zemmour, if that's the right pronunciation. And he's
pretty
a journalist. He's a journalist. Yes. And
that should be a disqualification right away, given
some people call him Francis Tucker Carlson. So, of course, the American Fox News guy. So, Jonathan, I assume then if he's Francis Tucker Carlson, he's on the right.
Well, he is. He's definitely not a socialist, that's for sure. He's in some ways, he's a very interesting guy. He's from a family of Algerian Jews. He's been very, very controversial. He wrote a really very, very good and sound, clever book about France and its decline. But needless to say, some of the things he had to say proved very controversial, and he's been repeatedly attacked for being a racialist and a fascist. Nevertheless, he has a very, very good style. He writes for Le Figaro. He appears on an evening TV show called CNews, where he's extremely intelligent, very polite. He has a very good style, a very good rapport with the Guadeloupean co-host, Christine Kelly. And he's got quite a following. Indeed, such a following that the polls say he could get 13% in the first round of the French presidential election next year.
And what would that mean if he got around 13%?
You know what? Am I allowed to say I don't know?
No, it's always hard to know because the vote's so split over so many different people in the first round.
It's a sort of circus maximus of hopes and ambitions. It has, you know, candidates from the clown car, you know, Napoleonists and Bourbonists and animal rights people. I would put in parentheses, I would probably vote for the animal rights people myself, as well as, you know.
Well, we can see that from your dog that's behind you, feeding you all the best lines.
He doesn't like me zooming. You've got complexity on the left as well with Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who's kind of the Jeremy Corbyn of France.
But doesn't go away, is forever there.
Doesn't go away. Well, you know, we'll get double digits of votes. You have Anne Hidalgo, the mayor of Paris, in the ring somewhere. You might have had Nicolas Sarkozy, but I think Carla is measuring up for curtains in La Santé prison at the moment. It's probably unlikely he will go there, but...
So tell us, if Zemmour was to run, what would be his appeal is he going to occupy some of the ground that Madame Le Pen and the Front National?
Le Pen is spitting bullets. As of last weekend, she was fâché, is the French verb to describe Le Pen, that anybody should dare challenge her. But more and more people on the right know that she's a toxic brand. She has a name that is associated with her father, who is really out and out an anti-Semite and kind of a very disreputable character. Even though she's moderated herself, she's not really, dare I say, she's not that clever. She gets eaten alive on television.
Yes.
She often starts these campaigns fairly strongly, according to the polls, but then she finishes very poorly, as she did last time. If it was the same rerun this time of last time, and it was the Le Pen-Macron race, it's quite possible Macron's victory might not be so overwhelming. But I still cannot see a scenario. I mean, the French people I know, and I know lots of different French people, they're not extremists, they're not crazy, and they don't want Le Pen as their president. And much as they don't really like Macron, very few people really like him, he is the quintessential lesser of two evils. However, Macron was very confident this was how it was going to play out. Macron versus Le Pen, again, in the second round.
Macron, winning
five more years, fantastic. Except that this little virus has come along, and it really... it's a fiasco in France. You know, we're not, there are no vaccines in sight around here. He's vulnerable on that. He's been protected a lot by the French media, who've not made a big deal of this. But it is becoming clear that the virus is not controlled in France. Infections are going up, hospitalizations are going up in Paris, in the East. And I think where you are, you may be having a weekend lockdown soon.
Oh, that's happened. There is now a lockdown from 6 p.m. on a Friday night to 6 a.m. on a Monday morning. We had it last weekend and we'll have it again. And there's talk of even more stricter rules to come in too. So I can understand why that makes Mr. Macron vulnerable. After all, he's meant to be a technocrat. So he's meant to do these things properly. So can I just stand back and is it possible that Zemmour, who may have more appeal on the right than Le Pen, given all the heavy baggage she carries with her, is it possible that he could be the one that goes through to the second round with Macron?
Well, anything's possible, Andrew. I mean, that's possible. It's also possible that Macron himself might not make it to the second round.
Because the vote percentage votes are always quite close together, aren't they?
It's
15, 16...
You know, it's a circus. You know, this system designed by de Gaulle, this two-round system, has a tradition, a history of throwing out candidates in the second round who were not really seen coming. 18 months to a year before these elections, all kinds of people who subsequently ended up getting through to the second round did. And some of them even became president, including Macron himself, who 18 months out was seen only by the most perspicacious French commentators, I won't mention any names, as having any chance at all. So it's a delightful unpredictability of this, which makes it happy days for those of us writing about French politics.
And Macron did it because there was an amazing confluence of factors took place that suddenly undermined the centre-left and the centre-right traditional candidates, and he came through the middle as the new man. But let me ask you another way. If, and you're quite right, we don't know, it is a bit of a crapshoot who gets through to the second round, but if Zemmour did get through to the second round, and it was a Macron-Zemmour a playoff, would he, am I right in thinking he would be a more formidable opponent than Le Pen for Macron?
It's possible, but the trouble with Zemmour, as much as Zemmour is a charming, smart guy, even if he has a talent for annoying people who, I confess, I'm happy to see him annoy, he's a little limited. He's a bit conventional. He's a bit French on the economic side. I mean, France is sort of, there's a sign on railway level crossings here, one train can hide another, and really one crisis can hide another. This virus is hiding these multiple crises that are confronting France, and on these crises it's fair to say that Zemmour has not had great things to say. He's kind of a Colbertiste. He's kind of a traditional big statesmanist
approach.
The TGV was brilliant. You know, the nuclear power stations were brilliant. They probably were in their time. But unleashing the genius of French people and their incredible talent and innovation and technical mastery of all kinds of difficult subjects, unleashing that from the dead hand of the state, well, that's kind of, to me, been the challenge for the last 20, 30 years. It seems never to have happened. And, you know, I wish if I, you know, were asked by someone, what do I need to do? You really need to have a more rounded policy. You know, Le Pen was very weak on this last time against Macron. Macron had all these things to say about the economy and slimming down the state and creating enterprise, which all sounded pretty good, very few of which he's actually succeeded in doing, by the way. But nevertheless, he said them. Whereas Le Pen didn't really have much to say on the economy at all, except not fully thought out plans to leave the euro, which, you know, which is a very complicated subject. She never really wanted.
Well, some of the economic policies weren't that different from Milenkov's.
No, in fact, you know, I, you know, it's a bit trite, but she's kind of a nationalist and a socialist. I won't say that she's a national socialist. She's not a Nazi much, but she is a socialist nationalist. I mean, she carries with her all that baggage of the, of that generation of French people who think that the state is, you know, étatisme. The state is, you know, the answer to everything. And these days, that's unlikely.
Indeed. Jonathan, we'll leave it there, but it sounds like you're not going to be short of things to write about for us in the weeks and months ahead. Thank you for joining us there.
Take care, Andrew. Bye.
The south of France. Indeed, thanks to all of our guests. And once again, a very special thanks to our sponsor, Charles Stanley, for sponsoring The Week in 60 Minutes. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms. It's one of the oldest firms on the London Stock Exchange. As always, send any thoughts to Spectator TV at spectator.co.uk. And of course, join us again next week. Bye-bye.